Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Reed, and this is the Midland Reporter Telegram Weekend Edition for Saturday, January 20th, 2024. Man shot, killed at Palladium Apartments. The Midland Police Department is investigating a homicide after finding a 26-year-old man dead at Palladium Apartments Thursday. According to a press release from the city, the Midland Police Department and Midland Fire Department EMS responded to the Palladium Apartments in the 2300 block of La Mesa Road about an unresponsive victim at approximately 8:52 p.m. When officers arrived, they found a 26-year-old man identified as Adarius Reed, who was pronounced deceased on the scene. During the investigation, Reed was found on the ground in the parking lot of the apartment complex with a gunshot wound. Two crime units, the Crime Against Persons Unit and Crime Scene Unit, were both notified and responded to the scene. No arrests have been made at this time, and the investigation is ongoing. MISD sees decrease in fights in first semester. At the end of last year's first semester, MISD reported 206 fights on district campuses. At the end of this year's first semester, it reported 127 fights. MISD released Friday that the year-over-year drop in the number of fights is due to stronger enforcement of campus policies, rewarding positive behavior, and maintaining clear expectations for students. At Tuesday's board meeting, MISD's violent and criminal data was publicly shared as a part of its 2022-2023 annual performance report. Executive Director of School Leadership Shannon Torres said Friday that more recent data from the first semester of this year shows a decrease in behavioral issues like fighting, controlled substance violations, and assaults against staff members. Torres said at the end of last year's fall semester, there were 66 assaults on employees across district campuses. This past fall semester, there were 39. Rewarding students' positive behavior and achievement, additional officers on campuses, and supporting teachers facing behavioral issues have also played a role. Quote, what I can tell you for the secondary schools is we are able to put several officers at our senior highs, which we have 2,500 kids at each. So that makes a big difference, end quote, Torres said. Quote, but the MISD Police Department as a whole, they are working together. The communication between officer and administrator is going strong, and the collaboration we have, I think, help make it safer for everyone, end quote. MISD hired Scott McCown as its new police chief in October. Torres said that two new MISD officers were sworn in this week. At Tuesday's MISD board meeting, MISD Superintendent Stephanie Howard said the MISD police force will be up to 26 once it onboards the officers it has, quote, in the queue, end quote. Torres discussed reinforcement of positive student behaviors on MISD campuses. Quote, all of our campuses have some kind of positive behavior incentives and really just recognizing the kids who are doing a job on a daily basis, kids who are meeting behavior standards and academic standards, but they do shout-outs, they do weekly prizes, they do drawings, Legacy does Rebel of the Week, end quote. Torres said the senior high schools in the district have had these programs for some time. But this year, more MISD junior high schools have placed an emphasis on recognizing the good. Torres stated in a press release Friday that MISD did not have to create new disciplinary policies, but better enforce the ones already in place. Quote, there are fewer incidents on campus and hallway behavior has improved dramatically, because students know there are consequences for infractions like fighting or even being late to class, end quote. Legacy freshman math teacher Kane Cardiel stated in a press release Friday. Midland Crime Stoppers asks for help with theft of necklace valued at $15,000. Midland Crime Stoppers is asking the public for assistance after the felony theft of a necklace valued at $15,000. According to police reports, a male subject went into the Zales located at the Midland Park Mall and asked to see the necklace. When the clerk was preoccupied, the male subject stole the necklace and left the store. Any information that leads to an arrest or a case being solved will be worth a cash reward of up to $1,000. No caller identification is ever used, and the call will remain anonymous. Please reference the Midland Police Department case number 240113019. Call 694-TIPS. Use the mobile app or www.694tips.com. The Open Show Winners List featured art and more. Permian Basin artists and supporters alike gathered at the Arts Council of Midland to celebrate night one of the Open Show, an annual open call dedicated to showcasing West Texas talent. A few months ago, artists began submitting their materials for the show in hopes of getting selected. Those who do then place their creations throughout the Arts Council home, displaying them to the community. Amy McBride, an instructor of art at Midland College, then selects the show's winners and honorable mentions. McBride has been the open show judge for multiple years. Emily Hatch, ACM's events and program coordinator, said although she's a musician first, being part of a nonprofit focused on highlighting visual efforts of the community is more than fulfilling. Quote, meeting artists and learning about new mediums has been amazing. I just love seeing the different avenues you can take and ways you can combine techniques, end quote, Hatch stated. This year, ACM awarded a Best in Show. First through third place and four honorable mentions. Svetlana Duncan earned Best in Show with her embroidery work done over watercolors, creating a three-dimensional piece made of colorful and textured mediums. The piece is called, quote, Cotton Fields, end quote. First place was awarded to Jeremy Mitchell, a photographer, for his sharp angles and bright contrast of, quote, the yucca, end quote, downtown. Quote, Gig in the Sky, end quote, a painting done by local gallery owner Beth Dixon, earned second place for its depth and use of shapes, color, and ingenuity. Cindy Olive took home third for her glass work known as, quote, Moondrops, end quote. A completely clear piece of stained glass, the piece contains multiple pieces of glass fused together and features a wet look to it as if it is being rained on. The 2024 honorable mentions were Jim Geetke, Cindy Johnson, Karen Lanier, and Cyril Montanola. Quote, it might be intimidating at first, but I hope when people come to see the show, they know they can start from anywhere. There are lots of artists in this show who submitted for the first time, or they're new, and they got in. It's an opportunity for people to see they don't have to be a trained professional, but can try something new, end quote, Hatch explained. The open show runs through February 25th. Guests can find the Arts Council at 1506 West Illinois Avenue. Operating hours run 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. Life Tributes. Robert Beck, 11-7-1946 to 1-13-2024. Abilene. Robert Miles Beck went peacefully to heaven on Saturday, January 13th at 1:15 p.m. in Abilene, Texas, surrounded by his family. He was born on November 7, 1946 in Austin, Texas, to Hugh and Helen Beck. He was preceded in death by his bride, Mary, his mom, dad, grandparents, and nephew, Zach. He is survived by his daughter, Marissa Johnson, husband, John, and grandchildren, Kennedy, Jack, Brock of The Colony, Texas, his daughter, Courtney Abraham, husband, Rennie, granddaughter, Annie, and soon-to-be granddaughter of Weatherford, Texas, his sister, Tony Berger, husband, Bill of Abilene, Texas, took such great care of him these last 2 years. His brother, Dana, wife, Nancy, of Ira Ann, Texas, and countless nieces and nephews. Bobby, will be cremated and buried at Rest Haven Cemetery in Midland, Texas, right next to the love of his life, Mary. A small graveside service will be held sometime in the spring. Memories may be shared and condolences submitted online at www.hamelfamilyfuneralhome.com. Florence Flo Beeson Curry, 12-11-1936 to 12-29-2023. Florence Flo Beeson Curry, a beloved mother and grandmother, died on December 29, 2023, at the age of 87. Flo was born on December 11, 1936, the second oldest of eight children of Mamie and Porter Beeson, who raised their family on a small farm in Broken Bow, Oklahoma. Flo was preceded in death by her husband, Max Earl Curry, and her infant son, Michael Ray Hall, her brothers Robert and Virgil Beeson, and her sisters Glenda Haltom and Sandra Mayfield. She is survived by her daughter, Angela Essman Spencer, and her husband, Greg of Midland, and by her son, James W. Essman, and his wife, Harriet of Midland. She is also survived by six grandchildren, Natalie, Gwen, and her husband, Tyler of Austin, Michael Spencer and his wife, Hannah of Austin, Emily Z. Chang and her husband, Derek of College Station, James P. Essman of Midland, Macy Essman Biano and her husband Vincent of Midland, and Smith H. Essman of Midland, and by eight great-grandchildren. She is also survived by her sister Lisa Meany and her brothers Bucky and Roy Beeson. There will be a small service for immediate family members. The family asks that in lieu of flowers, donations be sent to the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in memory of Flo Curry or to charity of your choice. Arrangements have been entrusted to Ellis Rest Haven Funeral Home in Memorial Park. Please visit ellisfunerals.com to leave online condolences. Ann Klein, 2-6-1935 to 1-10-2024. Virginia Ann Moulton Klein went to meet her Savior Jesus Christ on Wednesday, January 10, 2024. She died peacefully at the home she and her husband Bill shared for more than 55 years. Anne was born to Lois LaPrade and W.H. Moulton on February 6, 1935, in Mount Pleasant, Texas, in Titus County. She was preceded in death by her parents, Lois LaPrade and W.H. Moulton, son, husband, brother, and sister-in-law. She is survived by her children, Mary Ann, Pete Melanson Klein of California, Kathy Joe Copeland of Montana, Emily Eric Button Klein of Austin, Texas. She is also survived by her nephew, Billy Moulton, nieces Linda Moulton Terman and Cindy Moulton Carlson, along with their children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Memorials can be made to the following: Ann Klein Nursing Scholarship of Midland Memorial Hospital, St. Anne's Catholic Church, Attention Altar Society, Senior Life of Midland, Meals on Wheels. Public viewing and visitation will be held Wednesday, January 24th, 2024, from 2 to 6 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home, 4616 North Big Spring. The Rosary will follow at 7 p.m. at St. Anne's Catholic Church, 1906 West Texas. Mass will be celebrated on Thursday, January 25th, 2024, at 2 p.m. at St. Anne's Catholic Church, followed by interment at Rest Haven Memorial Park, 4616 North Big Spring. Arrangements have been entrusted to Ellis Rest Haven Funeral Home and Memorial Park. Please visit ellisfunerals.com to leave online condolences. Stephen Parnell, 9-25-1952 to 12-18-2023. Watoga. Steve Parnell, 71, of Watoga, Texas, passed away on December 18, 2023, after a lengthy illness. Steve was born on September 25, 1952, to Brian and Mary Parnell in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. He is survived by his wife Teresa, son Sean Parnell of Plano, Texas, and his children Presley, Finley, and Colby, son and daughter-in-law Tim and Allison Parnell, and their children Carmen and Declan, sister Rebecca Whitty. Steve was predeceased by his parents, brother-in-law Tony Gray, and brother-in-law Steve Whitty. A memorial service will be held in March at Fort Chadburn, Texas, with honors to be rendered by Goods Light Artillery and Dunholt Midkiff Camp 1441. James Lewis May, Ph.D., 10-29-1943 to 1-12-2024. James Lewis May, Dr. Jim, died on January 12, 2024, in Wimberley, Texas, after a lengthy battle with cancer. He was born on October 29, 1943, in Houston, Texas, the son of Loretta Henderson May and James Allen May. He is survived by his wife, Elizabeth O'Brien May, his children, Travis May, and his wife, Wendy Ann May, Jonathan Baru May and his wife, Micah Mojica May, his daughter, Meredith May Peeler, and her husband, Andrew Peeler, and his grandchildren, Ian May, Jackson May, Madeline May, Harper May, James Peeler, and Charlotte Peeler. His mother-in-law, Winnie O'Brien, sister-in-law, Gwen Emmett, and husband, Judge Ed Emmett, and brother-in-law, Tom O'Brien, and wife, Karen. A memorial service will be held at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church on January 27th at 2 p.m. In lieu of flowers, if you wish to do so, please make contributions to St. Stephen's Episcopal Church or St. Stephen's Episcopal School, Wimberley, Texas, or to the charity of your choice. Andre Borg Sanchez. Andre B. Sanchez, 77, passed away January 15th, 2024, at his home in Snyder, Texas. A private family gathering will be held in the spring when the fish are biting. Services are under the direction of Bell Cyper Seal Funeral Home. Andre's father, Lorenzo, was in the Army and stationed in France when he met and married Amy Borg. Andre was born in France on June 6, 1946. He was preceded in death by his parents, Lorenzo and Amy Sanchez, and pets Sledge and Tiger. He is survived by his wife of 43 years, Claudia, brothers Lorenzo Sanchez Jr., Shannon, and Luis Sanchez, Pam, nieces Michelle Garcia, Willie, Jennifer Shannon, Mike, Amber Cook, and Lauren Wade, nephew Luis Sanchez Jr., Casey, and his best friends Bandit and Gray C. Rita Darlene Luft, 629-1952 to 117-2024. Rita Darlene Luft, 71, died peacefully in her home in Midland, Texas on January 17, 2024, surrounded by her beloved and adoring family members. Rita was born on June 29, 1952 to Harold and Marietta McQuitty in Lamar, Colorado. Rita is survived by her only child, daughter Marina Benavides, Isabel Cabillo of Midland, Texas, and Costa Rica, her only grandchild, Alex Fields of Midland, Texas, sister Sandra Cooser, Barney Barham of Midland and Dallas, Texas, brother Danny McQuitty, Sandra of Midland, Texas, brother Tom McQuitty, Robin of Abilene, Texas, aunts Leanne Matthews of Austin, Texas, and Shannon Myers of Tucson and Pine Top, Arizona, uncle Frank Myers, Henry, and several beloved nieces and nephews with whom she shared many precious memories. She is preceded in death by her husband, Willard Luft of Freud, Montana, parents Harold and Marietta McQuitty, and her aunts Pat Cave and Sandra Schaefer, uncle David Myers. Rita's family will honor her memory in a memorial service to be held at a later date. Don Simpson. Don Simpson, 80, of Midland, passed away January 17, 2024. Viewing will be held from 1 o'clock p.m. to 6 o'clock p.m., Sunday, January 21, 2024, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will be held at 10 o'clock a.m., Monday, January 22, 2024, at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel in Midland, with interment following at Sunset Memorial Gardens in Odessa. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com.
For Texas Program of Blind Merchants, the pandemic shrank opportunities, exposed income gaps. For almost 40 years, Jerry House has stocked vending machines and staffed cafes across Texas's government buildings as part of the Business Enterprises of Texas program, a decades-old initiative that helps legally blind people become food service entrepreneurs. But at the annual conference in November, the first one held in person since before the pandemic, House said the program hit a new low. He could barely navigate the hotel. House, who is partially blind, couldn't find straight sidewalks through the courtyard to access parts of the hotel. It was difficult to find food or water, and he was one of the lucky ones. His girlfriend was there to help. Others had attended alone. You've got 88 blind people there. They know we need accommodations. They should be getting a hotel that's accommodating, House said. House has spent decades praising the program, but he and other vendors have seen a distinct change in past years. State agency shakeups and varying leaderships created issues with transparency and accessibility. And then the COVID-19 pandemic hit, fully knocking the program into disarray. Government-owned buildings shut down and emptied out. Once workers did return, they came in lower numbers on fewer days. The need for a full-time cafe shrunk into the occasional stop at a grab-and-go or vending machine. The pandemic devastated us, House 63, who sits on the elected committee of vendors and represents San Antonio, said. People sold their cars or their homes. They moved in with their family. They might have a little bit of vending, but that's still going on in their business, and they're struggling just to hold on until something better comes along. Even now, vendors say the program still hasn't fully recovered. The conference hotel was just one example of its problems, they said. A spokesman for the Texas Workforce Commission, which manages the vendor contract program and set up the conference in El Paso, said none of the registrants specifically requested accommodations for the hotel. But it said the commission still provided staff to help with guidance and directions to meetings and set out accessible forms of the meeting agenda. House said staff were around and helpful during meeting times, but for the rest of the time, like at night, people were alone. Catherine McKee, the commission's spokesperson, also said in a statement that the vendors whose income fell during the pandemic received $3,000 per month for 5 months in 2020. In 2021, the state distributed $1.2 million in federal funding to vendors, she said. The commission was not completely unresponsive to us, House said. I just feel like they dropped the ball in a lot of ways they really shouldn't have. Every state has its own version of a program for blind merchants. The programs were initially established as part of the federal Randolph-Shepard Act in 1936. Although guidelines have shifted over time, their purpose remains the same, to help advance the careers of blind people. Carla Martinez, age 48, finished her training and fully entered the Texas program in late 2010. Like other blind contractors, the state assigned her to operate a cafe in an Austin government-owned building. She enjoyed everything about it, interacting with people on a daily basis, managing her own business. But in 2016, the state dissolved the program's former agency parent, the Texas Department of Assistive and Rehabilitative Services, or DARS. The program then moved to the Texas Workforce Commission as part of an effort to consolidate state agencies. Even at that time, advocates worried about the move's impact on state services for the blind. DARS seemed like they were at least willing to work with us and they understood our disability, but TWC is all about, this is how we're doing business, you've just got to fit in. Martinez and other vendors say while the Texas program has offered them business opportunities, it could improve both its options and accountability. For example, some vendors feel there isn't enough transparency or organization around how the state chooses to assign individuals to types of facilities. The disparities in facilities can be gaping. Some vendors might make around $10,000 per year while working small routes for vending machines. Others, especially those who get assigned opportunities with the U.S. Department of Defense, can make hundreds of thousands of dollars per year. Vendors compete for these opportunities, submitting bids to the state for their ideas. The commission said it then selects someone based on a list of qualifying guidelines. Some vendors have felt frustrated with the process, though, because dozens of them compete over few lucrative spots. The state's department currently only has 4 military contracts as of 2024, TWC spokesman Erin Duffner said in a statement. Everybody has the opportunity to bid on facilities when they come up, Martinez said. I myself have bid on military opportunities. I have not gotten And when I was doing my applications, another vendor told me, "I don't know why you waste your time." The commission has attempted to close the opportunity gap, doing things like updating vending machine technology and replacing old equipment. McKee said it has tried to improve the efficiency of the program and continue to modernize opportunities, and it said it opened 6 new facilities of multiple kinds, including 1 military contract, since 2021. At the same time, 7 have closed since 2020, McKee said. But the Elected Managers Committee, which consists of program vendors representing different regions of the state, has advocated for all facilities to have a minimum per year income of $50,000, Martinez said. Martinez represents North Austin. As of September the 1st, the median of net vendor earnings was $47,513, but the average vendor earnings were $95,234, Duffner said. When the pandemic hit Martinez, she lost money and inventory. She went on unemployment for a month before picking up another job. It wasn't enough, so she restarted her work in the program at the Brown Heatley Building in Austin, which houses both the Texas Health and Human Services Commission and the Department of Family and Protective Services. Still, Martinez said her income has fallen. Her sales went from around $50,000 per month to around $10,000. As a result, she took on a temporary job managing a second cafe in 2022 in the William Travis Building in Austin, where Texas Public Utility Commission is located. Most people call me and they all say they want to re-sign because they don't see any solution. There is no light at the end of the tunnel, Martinez said. I'm very invested in this program, but I've been reconsidering it for a long time, but I have not made a decision to do it. I am still in survival mode. Since the pandemic, the number of vendors in the program has declined from 105 to 88. McKee said in a statement, the number of facilities opened has stayed around the same, currently at 114. While this seems small, Texas still has one of the biggest programs in the country, said Scott Egan, president of the Randolph Shepherd Vendors of America, an organization under the American Council of the Blind. This is partially thanks to the military contracts, he said. But the state could look into expanding the types of vending opportunities it provides because business as usual has been devastating for a lot of folks, Egan said. For House, he said the pandemic didn't hurt him as much as others because he already had started reducing his hours. Since 2005, he has both managed a coffee shop and stocked the vending machines at Brook Army Medical Center in San Antonio. Before then, he'd moved all around the state, like many blind vendors do, stocking and cleaning vending machines at a rest stop in Colorado County or running the cafeteria at the Lufkin State Supported Living Center, a residential institution for intellectually disabled people. But the way shutdowns were handled damaged his faith in the state's program. I went from nothing but praise for the program before the pandemic and before the change in leadership to now, House said, where every state has a program, and if someone's really interested, I would not advise coming to Texas. Chocolate Decadence fundraiser returns. Once again, chocolate lovers will be in heaven as the Aphesia Center of West Texas returns for its annual signature fundraiser. On January the 26th, the annual Chocolate Decadence fundraiser returns for its 19th year. The event is scheduled for 6:15 p.m. at the Odessa Marriott Hotel and Conference Center. Patrons can enjoy an evening of not only unlimited chocolate goodies, but also live music from the local band Current Nine, items to bid on at a silent and live auction, cocktails, a plated dinner, and the addition of a dance floor this year. The event will also have a slightly longer runtime this year than in the past. We're super excited about this year, Aphesia Center of West Texas Executive Director Kitty Binnick said. We've changed things up a little bit. We got some feedback from people who said they wish the event went on a little bit longer. So this year we have live music with Current Nine. We have a dance floor. What we're going to do is extend the time that the event lasts. After the live auction, the band is going to continue to play. We'll continue on with a bit of an after party. So we're excited about that this year. The event is one of the most crucial fundraisers that the Aphasia Center of West Texas does each year. It's been helping support the Aphasia Center for years. It's an important night for us because traditionally, this event has raised anywhere from 20 to 40% of our annual operating budget. It's a huge night for us. The Aphasia Center has gotten pretty dependent on this event. It helps keep the services of the center going throughout the year. It's important to us. It's a great way for us to spread awareness of aphasia. It's a great way for us to educate the community of aphasia. The event used to take place at the Midland Horseshoe Arena before being moved over to the Marriott in Odessa. The 2021 event was held virtually due to the pandemic before returning to an in-person setting in 2022. The event also used to take place in February, closer to Valentine's Day, but was moved to January a couple of years ago due to the amount of events taking place elsewhere in February. The fundraiser itself has stayed the same for the most part over the years. But we're excited about this year's live music. We always have live music, but to have a full 9-piece band will be great, as well as the dance floor after the party. We'll still have the chocolate and leftover chocolate for people to take home. However, this year there will be a few different chocolates to try. We always try to offer one or two things that are our taste bud teaser. This year, one of our featured items, and it's actually very good, it's like a small dill pickle wrapped in dark chocolate and pistachio nuts. Regular attendees need not panic, as there still will be the traditional chocolate truffles provided, as well as the chocolate martini. You can still have our traditional chocolate martini, but we also have our white flake martini, and it's made with white chocolate, and it's going to come with a souvenir snowflake charm around the wine glass. We just added a few little touches this year. And if you want to go, the event is on January the 26th at 6:15 p.m. at the Odessa Marriott Hotel and Conference Center, and you can purchase tickets online at aphasiatx.org/CD24.
Chemical manufacturer expands. Gardendale operation employs 550 people. The story was written by Bob Campbell. Based at Gardendale, oilfield chemical manufacturer JCAM Catalyst is adding 16 acres of land and 18,000 square feet of operational space to give it 65 acres and 90,000 square feet at 11999 Highway 158. President Vern Disney said he was proud to share the news of our corporate expansion. Quote, "This is a testament to our company's increasing footprint and our ability to deliver top-notch, cost-effective products to our loyal customers," Disney said. "We are well-positioned to take full advantage of future growth opportunities," end quote. With the additional land, JCAM, quote, "will support a greater capacity for manufacturing, laboratory support, and general operational support for over 550 employees in the Permian Basin and over 1,070 employees in the United States," he said. Disney said the company is the largest oil field chemical company in the basin, the second largest in the United States, and the second largest in the Mid-Continent and Rocky Mountain regions. He said JCAM Catalyst emphasizes providing customer service and tailored solutions to local problems through its decentralized model. Quote, "We are committed to customer responsiveness, on-time customer deliveries, and the necessary support and services for our customers," Disney said. "Our company is built by highly qualified and engaged employees with strong structural support for the overall success of our business. Our nimble approach allows us to meet the needs of our customers and continue providing them with the best in-class service and products for their chemical needs." End quote. With more than 50 locations across the United States, JCAM specializes in oilfield chemical manufacturing, blending, formulating, analysis, and research and development, and it offers chemical applications for oil and gas production, drill pipe and completion, stimulation, pipeline and midstream, and other specialty chemical needs. Quote, "With a commitment to providing a safe and healthy work environment, JCAM strives to protect the health and safety of its people, as well as to minimize their environmental impact," Disney said. Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, January 22nd. TxDOT issues traffic alert. I-20 main lanes in Midland County. The westbound right lane from Loop 250 to FM 1788 will have a slow rolling closure Monday from 9 a.m. until 3 p.m. The construction team will be milling rumble strips in the right shoulder. Obey warning signs and watch for slow-moving construction vehicles in this work zone. Expect delays or use an alternate route if possible. Stanglin brings radio expertise to ministry, church emphasizing service in 2024. The story was written by Bob Campbell. Alan Stanglin doesn't regret spending 15 years in sports radio before making his transition to the ministry because it was good preparation. Minister of Golf Course Road Church of Christ for 2.5 years, Stanglin had hit it big in the radio business as sports director at KRLD in Dallas, which controlled the Texas Rangers broadcast rights and covered the Dallas Cowboys home games. Quote, "I learned how to write, and it prepared me for being in front of a crowd," he said. "Working in the news, you have to do your homework and make sure your facts are straight. I like to concentrate not so much on what we're doing, but on what God is doing. I remind people that we were saved to be partners with Him. There is forgiving and reconciling to be done, and there are barriers to be broken down." End quote. Stanglin took a degree in mass media at Oklahoma Christian University in Edmond, and later graduated from the Austin Graduate School of Theology in Austin, and he came to Midland after 10 years at Central Church of Christ in Amarillo. He and his wife Carrie Ann have 3 children. Stanglin's 3500 West Golf Course Road Church averages 500 people at its 10:15 a.m. Sunday services. For the new year, it's emphasizing support of the Family Promise program to provide food and shelter and help families in transition, and it is asking its members to volunteer for 2 hours each month in that and other forms of service. Stanglin's favorite scripture is John 16:33, where Jesus' last words to his disciples before he was crucified were, "I have said these things to you that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world." We should have a sense of astonishment and amazement that our sins have been forgiven, Stanglin said. It's a miracle. We don't have to fight anything, and we don't have to win anything. It has been taken care of. I have the assurance of that. End quote. Downtown Church of Christ minister Greg Fleming, whose Midland Church started Golf Course Road in 1963, said Stanglin, quote, "is a man in keeping with Jesus' command in Luke 10:27, to love God and your neighbor. I see that play out in Alan's ministry and his connections with other ministers in our community, and his readiness to share the good news of Jesus in word and action with everyone he meets, Fleming said. We had a friend in common, Kim Scott, whom I first met when we were students at Lubbock Christian University, and who was a member of the congregation that Alan ministered in Amarillo. When Kim passed away last year, Alan's words at his funeral service blessed me greatly. It is my pleasure and privilege to count him as a friend. End quote. Cates, bystander CPR and AED use. The story was written by Carol A. Cates, Chief Nursing Officer, Odessa Regional Medical Center. I have a love-hate relationship with how healthcare is portrayed on TV and streaming programs. I love it because those mediums, with their broad reach, can bring so much awareness to important health and safety topics as part of a storyline on a program. The hate part comes in because sometimes the things they portray are incredibly inaccurate, which makes it hard when people come into the hospital with expectations based on what they saw on TV. One of the things on TV that is incredibly inaccurate is cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, and automatic external defibrillator, or AED, use. The differences between TV and reality when it comes to CPR and AED use are huge. Last week, I read an article that talks about how low the numbers are for bystander CPR and AED use, and it made me wonder if part of that isn't because of the way those things are portrayed on TV. I'm hoping by talking about CPR and AED use, if you are ever in a situation as a bystander, I can give you confidence to step in and start CPR and use an AED when one is available. According to an article recently published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, despite legislation aimed at increasing the availability of AEDs in public places, bystander use of those devices and accompanying CPR remains low. In the study, the researchers looked at 9,290 cases of witnessed cardiac arrest at multiple recreational facilities that had an AED on site. In those cases, while 46% of those people would have benefited from AED use prior to the arrival of emergency medical services, only 19% of people had an AED used. CPR was started by bystanders only 61% of the time. One of the main reasons the researchers believe that people are reluctant to start CPR or use an AED is because they are worried they will hurt someone. I am going to be brutally honest here and tell you something that I tell people who are new to healthcare when they do CPR for the first time. If you don't start CPR, that person is going to die. If you start CPR, they have a chance to live. Even if they get injured by the CPR, they're still alive. Bystander CPR makes a huge difference in survival. When a bystander starts CPR immediately, rather than waiting for emergency medical services, the person's chances of survival triple. The other thing people worry about with CPR is mouth-to-mouth. We have learned that, for bystanders, you just need to do chest compressions. This is called hands-only CPR. The American Heart Association has a great video on their website on how to do hands-only CPR. If you call 911, our wonderful dispatchers will also walk you through how to do hands-only CPR while you're on the phone with them. On TV, people use paddle defibrillators and patients convulse after they are used. To me, it always looks scary, painful, and, quite frankly, just awful. First, paddles are very old technology and rarely used anymore, even by healthcare professionals. An AED will not have paddles. We now use specially designed electrodes. They basically look like a square bandage made with thin foam on one side and a metallic finish on the other. The metallic side is sticky and goes against the skin on a person's chest. An AED will have pictures on the electrodes showing you exactly where to put them, and it will verbally walk you through every step of using the AED. The computer in the AED knows the times it will help and when it will hurt. You cannot hurt someone with an AED if you follow the directions it gives. The person might twitch a little, but they will not convulse like on TV. An AED will defibrillate someone when it detects that the electrical system of a person's heart has gone into pattern that does not allow the heart to beat in an organized fashion, which stops blood flow. Defibrillation acts almost like when you cycle the power on your computer, it resets it. That reset helps the heart beat in an organized way again, and blood flow starts back up. Just like with CPR, the sooner we can use an AED, the better. Survival increases significantly the sooner a person's heart returns to an organized beat. I hope you are thinking, I'm willing to try, so where do I go from here? First, while you don't have to have a CPR card to do CPR, I still highly recommend that everyone take a CPR class. That way, you can practice CPR and AED use before it's an emergency. Both the American Heart Association and American Red Cross websites can direct you to live and online CPR classes. If you can't take a class, I highly recommend you watch the hands-only CPR video I spoke of earlier. Second, whenever you are in a public place, look for signs for AEDs. That way you know where to run to get one or where to direct someone to get one if someone near you stops breathing or having a heartbeat. Finally, call 911 or get someone else to do so before you start CPR. You always want emergency medical services on their way to you as quickly as possible if you are ever in the situation. Plus, having that person on the line with you to coach is incredibly helpful as well. I hope you never need to do CPR, but even more, I hope if you are in that situation, you feel a bit more confident about stepping in and helping. Performing CPR and using an AED are a way we can all save lives.
Odessa to fund free diabetes clinic, January 17, 2024, by Mike Aldax. Odessa residents struggling to afford health care will soon have access to a free diabetes clinic. The Odessa mayor and city council recently voted to designate $500,000 in Federal American Rescue Plan Act funds, ARPA, to open the clinic in a partnership with the Medical Center Hospital System, MCH. The clinic will open at the site of the former MCH Urgent Care Clinic at 1940 East 42nd Street, near Permian High School, according to the current plans. The urgent care clinic was shut down during the COVID pandemic, according to the city. Offering 9 rooms for patients, the free diabetes clinic will provide an invaluable service to those who lack adequate health care, said Odessa Council Member Mark Mata. In addition to treating patients, the clinic will serve as a training grounds for up-and-coming physicians, the city said. At the onset, the clinic will open on a limited number of days and hours, according to the city. Odessa Mayor Javier Hoven, a diabetic and cancer survivor, said there's a need to fill a gap in education in the areas of diabetes, hypertension, and high blood pressure. I'm committed to improving the knowledge and pre-diagnosis in these areas for the segment of our citizens in Odessa who have limited access or no access to pre-treatment, the mayor said. The City of Odessa and MCH social media pages will provide updates on when the clinic will open. Find this story in audio for blind and low vision adults, 2 p.m. daily, on the Recording Library of West Texas radio station at www.recordinglibrary.org live stream.
MISD to review annual report at public hearing. Midland ISD will hold a public hearing for the 2022-2023 Texas Annual Performance Report during its board meeting on January 16th. According to a press release, Texas Education Code Chapter 39 requires each district's Board of Trustees to publish an annual report. The performance report discussed on January 16th will be based on 2022-2023 end-of-year accountability data. The annual report being discussed during the public hearing will include the Texas Annual Performance Report, financial reports, district accreditation status, campus performance objectives, the special education determination status, information on violent and criminal incidents, and information on the performance of previous year's graduates in their first year of college, according to the press release. The public hearing will happen at 5:30 p.m. at Bowie Fine Arts Academy.
Master Gardeners, brighten up your home with African violets. The story was written by Master Gardener Debbie Rowland. I prefer to grow my plants outside, but I have to say that African violets are beautiful indoor plants. If you grow African violets, you will have to resist the temptation to touch them. Just like everything in West Texas, they will probably get dusty. Use a soft, very soft, bristle brush and lightly dust them. They are one of the most popular houseplants and require very little but very particular care. This plant comes in many varieties and colors. Although we typically think of purple, they also come in pink, white, and red-violet. Each will bloom several times a year, flowering just above the foliage. African violets, as the name says, are native to Africa and require a well-drained but moist soil. Each plant will grow 6 to 9 inches tall and wide and are usually grown in a separate pot. Don't put them in too large a pot since they like to be cozy. Many gardeners grow their violets in teacups. They have a reputation for being somewhat difficult to grow, but if you follow some guidelines, your success rate will improve. Balance is required when watering. They thrive in humid conditions, but don't like water on their leaves, which can result in brown spots. Keep them moist and don't let them dry out. If brown spots appear, remove that leaf. Water from below, but don't let the plant sit in water. Some gardeners water by inserting the water spout on a watering can directly into the soil. African violets do not like the house to be below 60 degrees, and they don't like a draft. Indirect sunlight is best. They should be fertilized every other week in the spring and summer, and there are special products just for this plant. Always follow label directions and remember that more is not better. Once they bloom and the blooms fade, deadhead them to encourage growth. When your violets are established, you will be able to propagate new ones from your plant. Use scissors to cut off a leaf at the base of the plant at a 45-degree angle. Simply stick the cutting in a new pot. There are potting soils especially for this purpose, or you can mix your own using vermiculite and peat. When potting any plant, always mix water into the potting medium before using it. Potting soil that has been sitting on a shelf either at your house or at the store may have become hydrophobic, which is a tendency to repel and not absorb water. Soaking the medium in water before planting can eliminate that problem. These plants can grow and bloom year-round if properly cared for and can live for 20 to 50 years, so be prepared to make a commitment. If you have questions, call the AgriLife office in Odessa at 498-4071 or in Midland at 686-4700. Additional information and our blog for access to past articles is available at westtexasgardening.org. Click on Resources.
Dear Dr. Roach, I read your recent column about the 30-year-old pregnant woman who had a heart attack while working out in a spin class. She fell into a coma and was found to have a congenital heart defect. It seems to me that she likely has myocardial bridging, a congenital condition with the heart muscle wrapping around a coronary artery rather than under the vessel. When exercising, especially at peak effort, myocardial bridging tightens around the artery like a boa constrictor, cutting blood flow and provoking angina, shortness of breath, palpitations, and even cardiac arrest. This bridging is quite common. 1 in 4 people have some bridging, usually thin, partial bridges that are less than 1 millimeter thick, which don't cause symptoms. Thicker and deeper bridging, around 2 to 3 millimeters thick, completely wraps around the vessel and can strangle the coronary artery, causing angina, heart attack, or even sudden death. The young woman who had the cardiac arrest might have had myocardial bridging, which became more damaging due to the increased cardiac output of pregnancy, combined with the peak exercise at her spin class. As contractility increased, the bridging twisted and compressed her coronary artery more severely, like a tourniquet, and nearly killed her. Signed, Dr. K.R., M.D. Dr. Roach answers, I appreciate Dr. R. writing in. The large coronary arteries are epicardial, meaning that they run on the surface of the muscle of the heart, but sometimes muscle tissue can surround the artery. This is most common in the left anterior descending artery. As you say, if the muscle is thick enough, it can completely block blood flow through the heart while the heart is contracting. During exercise, the heart is contracting at a much greater proportion of time than it is while at rest. So it's during exercise that myocardial bridging can cause problems. Most people with bridging never develop problems. The diagnosis is usually made during an angiogram, but can now be made by CT scans. Treatment is with medicines, especially beta blockers, to slow the heart and reduce the amount of oxygen that the heart demands. Surgery may be necessary if medications aren't working, which may occur in people with larger segments of bridging. To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. Writers may write him at P.O. Box 536475, Orlando, Florida 32853-6475.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.